Hey everyone, this is Sung Soo, and if you want more content from Pat and I, you should check out our Patreon at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. Each week, we release what we call an after-the-credit scene, which is like a bonus episode. Lately, the bonus episodes have been longer than our main episodes. We tend to go a little bit deeper, a little more nuanced into different strategies we're doing. So, if you're interested in hearing more of Pat and I, check out patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. If just one episode of Pat and I a week is enough for you, and I can't quite say I blame you, then hey, no need to check out the Patreon. I want to thank you very much for listening to this podcast. Hey, everyone, this is Sung Soo, and if you want more content from Pat and I, you should check out our Patreon at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. Each week, we release what we call an after-the-credit scene, which is like a bonus episode. Lately, the bonus episodes have been longer than our main episodes. We tend to go a little bit deeper, a little more nuanced into different strategies we're doing. So, if you're interested in hearing more of Pat and I, check out patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. If just one episode of Pat and I a week is enough for you, and I can't quite say I blame you, then hey, no need to check out the Patreon. I want to thank you very much for listening to this podcast.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high.
Welcome back to the latest episode of Across the Bifrost. My name is Sung Soo, and I'll be joined in a moment by the dear, not very sinister, Pat Dunford. And today, we're going to be covering the three brand new, I guess they're not brand new, but the three newest Crisis for Atomic Mass Games Marvel Crisis Protocol. But first, let's check in with Pat. Pat, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you, TT. I think these crises are pretty brand new. Two of them arrived in my mailbox a couple of weeks ago, and the third has yet to be released in the UK. So that's about as new as it gets. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. And I honestly, I need to check. Maybe I have some of these in my mailbox. I'm honestly not sure. And the releases, again, have just been kind of crazy. So I do want to ask, before we jump into this, Pat, I had a couple different people ask, what's your favorite snack food?
What is my favorite snack food? Okay, I feel like I'm being set up, but I'm going to answer anyway. Honestly, ever since I've been a kid, I've just loved fruit. And I always had a good habit, which I don't particularly like crisps or chocolate. I mean, it's good, don't get me wrong, I'll eat it. But I would always choose an apple, right, over that. And so that has to be my favorite snack food, like a Granny Smith, a Cox's, something like that.
So a crisp, to be clear, is a potato chip?
That's right.
Okay, that's probably my favorite snack, which is not good. It's bad for you, right?
Shocking. But it's delicious.
So wait, what are your favorite apples? I've heard of the Granny Smith. That's a green apple, right? It's green here in America. That's what was your other one?
Cox, which is like a very sour, part red, part green apple. Golden Delicious, of course, always a favorite.
Okay.
I think that's a French apple.
I have no idea. We have a lot of Fuji apples here in America, and then Honey Crisps have been real popular lately. I don't know if you see those over there.
That's nice. I think Fuji is similar to Golden Delicious.
Okay, does anyone actually eat the red Delicious apple? Because that thing just tastes horrible.
Yeah, it's got kind of like a waxy skin.
And it's mealy on the inside. It's not crisp at all. It just kind of falls apart.
It's not the best, that's for sure.
No. So when you go to gaming conventions, you'd bring apples with you then. Is that correct?
No.
What was your favorite snack?
I know. To be fair, I don't bring any snacks with me when I go to gaming conventions. But I just try to eat balanced whole meals. I make great efforts to make sure I have a really big breakfast, usually healthy, and that's where I'll get the fruit crammed in. And then I will often steal maybe an apple or a banana from the breakfast buffet. But I'm not, you carry around so many models, at least back when I was doing War Machine conventions. Haven't been very many opportunities for MCB conventions yet. I carry around so many models, I didn't want to carry snacks as well.
Really? The snacks were just, that was the cutting point?
Yeah, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Oh, okay. Good to know. So what is a English breakfast? Because I know like the definition of bacon are different, right? Like curly bacon is your bacon and like normal bacon's ours or something. I can't
normal
remember.
Bacon.
Yeah, you heard us. Normal.
Yeah, you like strip bacon. Like little, yeah. I mean, there's lots of, basically, my experience has been most countries do different bacon and it's all pretty delicious. It's all just, you know, pig flesh, fat. Salt.
But what is breakfast for you?
It could be a bunch of things. Like, hotel buffet is usually whatever you fancy, right? Which is one of the appeals. But English breakfast, which is not something we eat every day in the UK, right, is that classic fry breakfast of like sausage, bacon, mushrooms, beans, hash browns, maybe potatoes, pudding, that kind of thing. Yeah, baked beans. That's a very
for breakfast.
Thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like canned baked beans in the
yeah. We don't have them for breakfast.
I'm sorry to say, they are ubiquitous in English breakfast, and in my opinion, they're the worst part. They kind of just cover the plate and make everything taste of bean. But there you go. They're popular.
I didn't know you had baked beans for breakfast. My dad couldn't cook growing up, so he'd make three meals. He'd make pancakes, grilled cheese, and he'd cook the grilled cheese with the iron, like the iron that you use to clean your clothes or straighten your clothes. And he'd cut up hot dogs and put them in baked beans, and he'd call it a casserole. That was my,
meals. That sounds like something. My pro tip for cooking baked beans to make them a bit more edible is add a good amount of butter and a lot of ground black pepper. And then you get more of a tastier sauce, and it makes the whole thing much better.
Interesting. I normally end up putting like some molasses into my baked beans to give it a little more. But anyway, I think we're off topic here. We're talking about crisis, and I think the first crisis we want to talk about is Research Station attacked. And real quickly, I'm going to run through it again, just kind of blitz through this thing. It's a 16 threat extraction. You have one researcher on the central point of the EMAP and then two evac points, targets of opportunities, on the other two. A player scores two victory points if they are securing the researcher during the cleanup phase. Then a player scores two VPs if the researcher is within one of their evac point during the cleanup phase. Then during the power phase, the researcher may move. If a player is securing the researcher, they may place it within two of its current location. The evac point farthest away from the player's boards is their evac point. So we described this as kind of reverse tug of war when we covered this in the box. So, Pat, do you like Research Station Attacked?
I love it. I think it's really, really fun. I really like how this is an extract that plays like a secure. And it is an extract as a result that favors characters who are good on secures and does not give the same advantage to maybe a character like Angela that traditional extracts do. It stops some of that runaway play that some extracts have and forces a scrap in the middle of the table.
So that's something I want to hit on real quick. You said it stops kind of the runaway play. At the surface, this could be four VPs around. But realistically, in my playing, it's basically a two VP scenario. And then a lot of times, the four is kind of what closes out the game.
Yeah. I think if you're scoring four, like, because you... in the fastest you can score four is you need to have controlled it twice, right? The first move, if you move it directly towards your evac point, gets you about halfway there, and then the second one gets you to within range. So scoring four is good, but you have to have already won it twice without your opponent winning it in order to get to that position. And as a result, it feels like when you're scoring four, it's almost like a winning more situation. Now, to be fair, that's not entirely true, because your opponent could be winning on the secure, right, in other parts of the table. But I agree with you that I've found that it doesn't come up that often that you score 4 points. And what I've found myself doing more is just positioning it as the controlling player so that I keep control of it and make it harder for my opponent to score it at all. Like, I find I use that move to keep scoring two rather than to try to get four later.
Yeah, because to your point, right, the earliest you could score four would be round three, right? Because you would move this at the power phase of round two, the power phase of round three, so then the cleanup phase of round three, we theoretically could score the four, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that's, yeah, again, right, even playing gamma, right? How often are you scoring your opponent's gamma? And again, it happens reasonably often. But it's the safer play, right, to just put it somewhere where, again, you kind of have that safer nest hold, right? And yeah. And I've been following a similar path, again, unless you feel like you're down and then you've got to push.
Yes, exactly. And that is interesting, right? At least there's some interesting decisions about when do you push forward with this and when don't you. It means that to some degree you can't afford to completely ignore this, although I would never advocate for ignoring an extract that's worth 2 or 4 points. But the most common time I think that I do score 4 on this is when my opponent undercommits to it, right? Maybe we're playing on something like this plus infinity formula, and they evenly split their characters between the infinity formulas and this, and then you can just push a bit harder in the middle and score lots of bonus points. But yeah, I don't think it hasn't come up for me often. And I really like just keeping that secure safe and making it so my opponent has to keep spending move actions to contest it and keep worrying about moving my characters off.
So one of the questions I did have about it, obviously in our last After the Credits scene, which is a bonus episode for patrons, if you're interested in checking that out, you can find us at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost, is how do you feel this combines with Gamma or Demons Downtown?
To create just a big slugfest in the middle of the table. Well, it definitely combines them, right? It creates some interesting tension with demons, because one of the things that I find playing demons in other crisis combinations is demons is only worth 3 victory points. Whoever goes into the middle gets a slight edge, but going into the middle on demons is like a death sentence, because you're in range of your opponent's team and you're incinerated. And so usually, like, some plucky character moves in at the end of round one and then gets annihilated at the start of round two. So people don't want to do it. And what I found in demons is people tend to instead focus on the extracts and maybe leave that middle point or send someone totally expendable to give them a victory point on it. But then, of course, when you combine this with demons, that completely changes. And suddenly the middle of the table is the most important and valuable point. And it leads to this, like, horrific annihilation where you want to cram all of your characters into the center, and you're incentivized to put more than your opponent. So both people keep piling in characters, but then they all get incinerated. They all start within range of each other, and they're all constantly fighting over the super valuable point that's right in front of them. So it definitely creates a different crisis that is the most combat-focused crisis I think I've ever played.
I've had a similar experience with it, and I was playing Avengers. I did not want it to be that combat-focused, but it was a great learning experience, and I think it was an interesting one on it. So kind of to dovetail off that, who likes this crisis? Who enjoys, what kind of characters or affiliation enjoys playing on Research Station Attacked?
Great question. Maybe we'll take turns with this one, because I can think of a few, but I'm sure more will come to us. So I mentioned already that characters who traditionally like secures like this, right? And I mentioned that characters like Angela don't. So just to expand on that point, I think when you have those characters that are just good at standing on points, that are hard to move, that are tough, this crisis looks really appealing. They don't need to be that fast. So, for example, Crossbones is an example of a character who really likes this crisis. He's tough. His aggressive ability means it's hard to push him off, and he can reach it in the first round.
Yeah, and I think, like, the logical follow-up to that would be Criminal Syndicate, right? I think Criminal Syndicate enjoys this kind of thing. Obviously, that's Crossbones and Kingpin are kind of the centerpieces of that, and a bunch of different other characters kind of fill in around it. I do also think that Brawling Teams enjoy this, right? Brawling Teams, the teams that are normally forcing Gamma or Demons, I think you can end up with an interesting situation on Gamma or Research Station Attacked as well.
Yeah, I think this might be the most appealing extract for Brawling Teams, because the thing that Brawling Teams want is they want to force their opponent to get close to them so they can beat them up. And this is the only extract that completely forces your opponent's hand at where they put their models. So I wouldn't be surprised if it gains increased popularity as people start to figure that out.
Yeah, it's also, you know, it's a slower one, right, when we compare it to some of the other extracts that we see out there, which, again, tends to fall into what the Brawling Teams want to do, right?
Yeah. I wonder if it combos poorly with some of the other secures. You asked me about Demons and Gamma. Have you had any experience playing this on something like Infinity Formula, where you suddenly you have 5 points all very spread out, or indeed on any D secure crisis?
I have, and it's an interesting one, right? I found myself not wanting to push the researcher to... I completely give up the hope of scoring 4, and I just want to get the researcher to where I can score it using one character. Does that make sense? Where I want to get away from playing a 4-pointed scenario or 5-pointed scenario, and I want to be playing in a 4-pointed scenario. And it was interesting, right? And I think you just have to prioritize, okay, one of them's worth 2, right? The other one's only worth 1. Which one can you kind of give up?
Yeah, so it's, you certainly, in those situations where there's lots of points to cover, you have to weight this more highly, and you end up in this slightly awkward situation where, like, at least all things being equal, right, just ignoring the specific characters and what the players are doing, but generally speaking, one character on each side will cancel each other out. So you end up with this kind of tension where you want to cover as many points as possible, but you also want to have one more character in the middle than your opponents. So how do you reconcile those things? Do you both just keep adding characters to the middle? Or does one of you, one player spread out, but then the other person doesn't have to commit very much to the middle and gets all the extra points?
Yeah, I think for me, I tried to identify if there was one or two opponent characters I could get in early days or KO on, like an advantageous one to hopefully swing that balance. So then in the mid to later games, theoretically, I could have the character advantage. But that's going to vary wildly matchup to matchup, right, Pat?
Yeah, for sure. It's very dynamic, though. And it's one of the things I love about this crisis. It completely changes how you approach the game and your strategy.
Yeah, it's interesting. So then who wants to avoid this crisis?
Characters that really love playing with extracts, right? Angela can't do her turn one shenanigans. Amazing Spider-Man, the same. Characters like Quicksilver with his Team Tactics card and Enchantress can't steal extracts. Although having said that, I mean, Enchantress can still make you move off the point. So she's actually superb in this crisis. I take that back. Between her beam and the ability to move people. But generally... Well,
it's an interesting one for Enchantress, though, right? Because, like, do you want to shove Enchantress into the middle of the board, possibly past the middle of the board if you're going for the four-pointer? I do agree the bow and the beam are very powerful. But as far as bad crises for Enchantress go, this might be up there, right?
Yeah.
I guess Herb is worse.
Yes. I think the thing... I don't think it is bad for her at all, though. I think the strategy, if you're running Enchantress on this crisis, is you activate her as late as possible. So that would be last if you don't have priority in a lot of circumstances. And then you advance her once, beam all of your opponent's characters who are on that point, and move all of them off the point. So I think an Enchantress activating last on that crisis is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, that makes a good point. Are there other? So what crises do we think we would want to take with it? If we've decided we want to play Research Station Tact, what are some other extracts or secures we'd want to take with it so we end up with a similar game plan every time around?
Yeah, so I think this is super unique, right? It's the only extract that plays like a secure in this way. So I think more than any other crisis, it's hard to identify overlap that plays in a similar way. You can't just do something like with Skrulls and Alien Ship or with Terrigen Mist and Mephisk, right? You can't play two crises that are incredibly similar and always have one to pick from when you've discarded one of your crisis cards. And actually, there aren't really any other extracts that force you into the middle of the table like this. I suppose the closest are the extracts that have a single high priority, right? A single point that you pick up.
Yeah, for me, it's been like, if you're a secure team, if you normally want to play the secure, I think this is just another one you take when you get pushed off of it, right? Because, just to your point, I don't see a great mirroring or parody to it, right? Like, right? You're talking about Skrulls or Alien Ships, right, for the single points, but, like, those are the randoms as to whether you get the thing, which is obviously a completely different gameplay, right? This one also doesn't require any power for interacts, which is really interesting. It's another thing you can leverage if your team isn't very power hungry or if you just have other plans for your power early on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this actually, bizarrely, doesn't pair with other extracts, right? It pairs with secures. Like you said, if you're a secure-focused team, you take this extract when your opponent selects secures and you need to pick an extract. You get to play a secure-focused extract instead of your normal secure. And if you're a kill-focused team that would love to play something like Gamma Wave or Demons Downtown, you take this when your opponent doesn't let you pick that and you have to pick an extract instead. So it kind of fills in for those teams so they can have a central-based thing that they secure regardless of if they're given extracts or secures by their opponent.
So last thing, what do we think about the threat? It's a 16 threat one. Well, you know, how do we feel about more 16 threats being in the game?
I feel pretty good about 16 threat. I like it. It's not really common. And just losing that one threat value from 17 adds a little bit of interesting tension into list building, where you need to have really powerful options at 17 for pretty much every team. But then you also need to just think, how do I lose one threat value from my squad? Do I downgrade like a 4 threat to a 3 or a 3 to a 2? Do I combine 2 threes into a 5? You know? You've got options, lots and lots of options, but you just need to make sure your squad is flexible enough to cover it.
Yeah, and I think this is the third 16 in the game, if I remember correctly. And my recent squads have filled it in just fine. But I remember when I was playing Black Order, I actually really didn't like playing on 16, for example. So just be aware of, like, what 16 are you going to put down on the table when you're considering if you want to play Research Station Attack. So do you have any closing thoughts on Research Station Attack? I think it's really, really cool. I love the design space of it. I like that it changes the preconceived notion we have about what an extract is going to be. I think it's a really cool addition.
Yeah, I agree. I like it as well, and I'm excited to see if we get any more crises like this down the line. To your point, then maybe we can start to combine them together.
All right, so the next one up is Deadly Legacy Virus Cured, which is a 19-point extraction. It's got a lot of words, and it's already received an errata. I think the big errata is this is actually supposed to be on the C map and not the E map, right, Pat?
Yeah, that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. So it's supposed to be that you play with a line across the table, not a line with one near you, one near your opponent. It completely changes how easy it is to score multiple of these in the first round. Sorry, when I say score, to collect multiple of these in the first round with a single character. It makes it much more difficult to create a situation where you steal your opponent's cure plus the central cure, and then just pick up your own in a second activation on the first round. It definitely makes the crises more balanced. But having said that, it's still a crisis where one player is going to get an advantage over their opponent, right? Somebody is going to go up 2-1 on the first round, most likely. So I can see it being appealing for people that want to use that strategy.
And I guess to reiterate, right, this one, we end up with three legacy cures. You interact to pick it up. A character scores one VP for each legacy cure held by a character they control in the cleanup phase. There's no limitation to how many of these you can hold. There's a benefit for it for each one that you end up holding. I think at the end of the, I think it's the end of activation, you get to remove a special condition. Note, this isn't a shake, so it would work even if you're close to Scarlet Witch or Crystal. And the last thing is, if you're really lucky, if you get all three, you are removed from the game, you're KO'd, but you score 8 victory points. So the reason it's important that Pat said for the shift from the E to a C is it's so much easier to pick it up in the E when you just have to move down that single line, right? Mm-hmm. You theoretically could do that with 2 move actions, normally 3. It's a lot harder to do that when you have to go left to right.
Yeah, much, much harder. So I think this crisis is really cool. Have you enjoyed it, TT?
The teams I've been playing recently have been very scenario focused, and I don't have a great plan to score all 8. So for me, this one's been very slow, and I've preferred more assets being on the board for my extractions recently. But it's been fun to play, and the threat of 8 is scary.
Yeah, I think it's really fun because you end up with this really interesting tension. I don't know if you feel the same way when you play it, but for me, I'm always thinking, what if I can get all three on one character? What if my opponent manages to get all three from under my nose? And the 8 points is just almost always enough to completely swing a game, right? Especially after the first couple of rounds, it's usually enough to just win on the spot, even if you're behind. So I found it to be really interesting that it makes me think about, do I want to make some sort of all-in play to collect all three extracts in a way that other crises wouldn't make me think about, right? Because the payoff would be so much lower. And I think that's really fun. And it certainly worked out to force my hand to protect those cures a lot more than I would protect some other extracts.
I think that's a great point. You have to treat it as though it's way more than a 1-point extract, right? Because the threat of, okay, they picked up a daze I didn't see coming, so they got one off me there, and I know they have Enchantress. Like, after that, it's just like, can they move it around somehow? Do they have Toad or Mission Objective or some way to manipulate these to get them on the same character? It becomes a really interesting, I think you used the word tension, right? And that's definitely true. So I've enjoyed playing on it. It just hasn't fit what I've wanted to do with my rosters recently.
Yeah, I agree that it's a little bit awkward to have teams that consistently take advantage of the map layout with the C map, because it's quite, well, it depends, right? You can have that classic plan of having a fast mover swoop in and take one straight away. then you assume your opponent takes one, and then as the player with priority, you take another. But it's hard for teams to have two characters that can both take an extract in the center of the table without retaliation. So you are, with a lot of teams, if you take this extract with priority, you can expect to take two out of three because you've got priority, but you can't necessarily expect to hold them for the whole round. So I've found that in my planning, I like playing this crisis a lot, but I haven't personally put it in very many of my rosters.
It's an interesting one. I think it's one, and again, I haven't been playing someone like Angela, who's able to normally get this and stay safe, right? I've been running Toad as kind of a reactive thing, but it's not, again, it's just not the way that I've wanted to play the game. I'm not saying it's bad. I think it's a fun crisis, a good addition to it. But again, I my rosters don't really fill out 19 that well recently, and then it just isn't what I want to do. But I like it. I think it's a good addition. So if we've both been kind of avoiding it, Pat, who are the people that want to play in this crisis?
I think there's very specific characters that get huge benefit from this crisis. And actually, we've named some of them already. It's characters that have interesting interactions with extracts, right? Because the payoff for managing your extracts in such a way that one character ends up with all of them is so big. And that's a unique mini game that doesn't really exist in any other crisis. So you mentioned Toad. Toad's excellent, right? Because he's a really good character for grabbing one of these straight away and doing it with relative safety because of Slippery. And he has this ability where he can collect extra cures from your other characters. So he can grab one on turn one, and then over the course of the game, start collecting the others. And you can play this mini game with Toad, where you're only devoting a two threat character to the plan, but you can expect at some point you might be able to have him collect them all and win the game for you.
Yeah, I think just to dovetail on that, right? Kingpin is the other one that jumps out to me, right? The piece of the criminal syndicate leadership that everyone forgets is their ability to spend two and to move something they're holding to someone else, which is obviously, you know, one of the few ways in the games we have to move these asset tokens around.
Yeah, very, very strong with criminal syndicate. And I wouldn't be surprised if this becomes a very popular extract for them. In addition, you mentioned already, but Enchantress, really scary. One of the things that's terrifying about Enchantress is the fact that she can take the extracts off the opponent without rolling any dice. And you can end up in this situation where you don't want to have your extract holders near each other, because if Enchantress gets into the mix, she can end up moving your characters around, taking all the extracts. And even if you have them spread out on different characters, she can end up scooping them all up.
Yeah, that's another good point to consider there. So who wants to avoid this crisis in particular?
You know, I'm not sure that there's that many people that really want to avoid it. I think maybe you need to consider the speed. If you don't have a plan to collect all of the cures, this is quite a slow scoring crisis, but it's not the slowest. So I think if you just want to score a mediocre amount of extract points, if that's your plan for extracts, then this is fine. But it's pretty rare that that's your plan, right? Either you want to score lots of extracts or you want to score as few as possible. So I don't know who doesn't like this, or indeed who really picks it. I don't know. I'm not sure, TT. What do you think?
I think you pick it if you think that you can score the eight better than anyone else, right? That to me is the only real draw to this extraction. Is I believe that my roster is favored at getting me the eight. Mm-hmm. And personally, I think if you're not that roster, this shouldn't be in your list. Because there are other ways to do mediocre scenario play, right? There are ones that are going to be slower. There are ones that are going to be faster. Yeah. And normally you're going to favor one of those. I think the only reason to put this one in is if you think you can dunk the eight.
Yeah. I mean, even if you want to have an extract that scores a medium amount of points, if you get priority and you're picking extracts, I'd rather have Montesi formula, because that gives a bigger advantage to the player with priority. And it's much easier to go 2-1 up with priority when you pick Montesi formula. So yeah, I agree with you. If we think this is only really for people building around it, then I think it's probably worth mentioning a couple of other characters that are good on it. One of those is Miles Morales. right? Venom Blast is really good at shaking free the opponent's extracts. And because it doesn't force Miles to pick them up in the same way that, for example, Enchantress has to actually collect it, you can drop their extract so that your character that's already holding the cures can go and scoop up the final one.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to point out, what you said with Venom Blast. It just makes them drop it. Miles doesn't have to be the one to pick it up. Is this when we see professionals? Do we bring professionals out here, Pat?
Maybe. I mean, certainly, I think if this is your game plan, you do want to consider devoting team tactic slots to it. I'm not sure professionals is the best choice. Can I borrow that for Quicksilver is interesting. And then I think the best tactics card for supporting this plan in general has to be mission objective, right?
Absolutely. And I think the key to hit on this that people don't remember is mission objective is both active or reactive. So many people only associate it with the reactive side, right? Which is when you would be forced to drop it. You can move it instead. You can just choose to use it as an active card to go ahead and move the thing off as if you were Criminal Syndicate.
Yeah. So you can just get all of the extracts onto a single character, which normally is not that important, but as we said, really important for this. The final character that I wanted to call out was Syn, right? Her leadership makes people drop extracts. And maybe that is something that you want to bank on to disrupt your opponent's plan and try and collect all of the extracts on a single character.
Yeah, that's that weird scornergy, right? Where Syn, so you want to go wide, so you're near people. If you're wide, you probably want to have priority, so they drop them and you don't have a chance to pick them up. But I understand where you're going. It's not a bad use of Syn, and you don't have to go wide, right? You could go with an elite team circling around her.
Yeah, absolutely. Bear in mind, Enchantress is great at this, and she's in the same affiliation as Syn, right? You could have a plan where between Enchantress and Syn's leadership, it's just so hard for your opponent to hold on to the extracts, and they constantly have to be mindful that they could be in situations where you can just activate with priority and scoop everything up.
Yeah, definitely something to think about. But for me, still, like, I don't really want to build a team around this. I think if you end up with a team that tertiarily is good at it, it's a good affiliation to put in there, right? But it's the same argument that we've had in the past, right? You're only going to get to pick this half the time. And of those times, right, one third of the time, the thing's going to be killed. So I like it. I just, it's not making it for my rosters right now.
I think the way I'd include this in rosters is if I had a bunch of stuff in my roster already that works well with it, and then I realized I had a spare slot. So one of the classic things that happens when you're building a roster, right, is you pick the two extracts that's your primary game plan, and then you have a third left over. And because you only ever discard one of your three, you don't need all three to be your primary game plan. Well, this can be your cool backup plan, right? And for example, using the Syn example that we just said, right, if I'm already playing Cabal and I already have Syn and Enchantress, yeah, maybe I just throw in as my third crisis option this, and that's good enough. And maybe if I'm playing single affiliation Cabal, I have a spare tactics card and I throw a mission objective, you know? And maybe all of a sudden I've got this extra game plan that I can pull out if I need it without really damaging my roster composition very much.
Yeah, and I think that would be the way I would approach it as well. The only thing I'll say is you said maybe a whole lot in that last scenario, but I'm with you. That is basically the case that would have to come up for me to use this thing as well. So I like it. I think it's really cool. I love the Rube Goldberg machines people come up with to utilize this thing first turn, right? And obviously switching from an E to a C has hampered a lot of those, but I love the machines that are like, oh, okay, on turn two, we can get this off. I think those are really cool. I think they're fun thought dives. I think they're janky. I think they often fall prey to manipulation on the board, but I think they're really cool to see what everyone comes up with.
Yeah, for sure. I really enjoy the gameplay of this crisis, and I'd also just highly recommend it. If you want a crisis to play for fun, it adds a lot of excitement and tension, and it's always really fun when someone does manage to collect all the cures and explodes.
I think it might be one of the ones I use for demo games in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Good call.
So the last crisis we have is Sword establishes base on Moon's blue area. It's a 14-point secure. So, I've read the last two, Pat. Why don't you give them a brief high-level overview of this one?
Sure. So, for those that aren't familiar with this crisis, this is coming out in Cable and Domino's box that may or may not have released in your part of the world. The setup for this is you place three consoles on Map C. And the player who controls the most consoles scores 3 victory points during the cleanup phase. So this is an all or nothing crisis. One person gets all the points, the other gets none. You interact with a console, and if there are no enemy characters contesting it, you gain control of it. However, if one or more enemy characters are contesting it, you roll a dice. And if you get a crit, wild, or hit, which is a 50-50 chance, you are controlling the console. Finally, the person that controls more consoles during the power phase gets to activate the security system, and they get to push a enemy character short in any direction.
So it's kind of like Meteors, right, Pat?
Yeah, this is an updated Meteors. So when Senators came out in Magneto's box, we talked about how it was like an updated Skrulls, right? It used the same mechanic with less randomness. And this is kind of like that. It uses the same map layout as Meteors. It uses the same scoring system. But you don't need to worry about your energy defense on your characters anymore, because the dice rolling is the same for everyone. And it has a different level of randomness. I'm not sure if it's more or less random, but a key point is, if no one is contesting these points, you score them automatically with no dice rolling required, which is zero randomness compared to having this really frustrating chance on Deadly Meteors that you can come in with your character, roll a bunch of dice, get no successes, and then not score any points. Right, so that bit is removed. On the other hand, if anyone is contesting, you only have a 50-50, which is about as random as it gets. So what's your take on that, TT? Do you think this is an upgrade or a downgrade from the mechanics of Deadly Meteors?
Both. I like the non-random interaction to start with. I think that's a huge upgrade. I can't tell you the amount of games that I've lost or come really close, because I'm the only one on this Far Meteor and I just can't flip the thing. I remember one game, Mystique failed 4 flips on thing. I get it. She doesn't have a great defense on Meteors, but she's alone. She should be able to figure this out. She's got 4 rounds to do it. And we ended up losing that game because of it. Well, other reasons too, obviously. This is one of many reasons we lost the game. So I really like the, if there's no one there, you can just take control of the thing. I think that's really, really cool. I don't like that it's just a 50-50 flip after that. I prefer Meteors where my roster might be able to have an advantage. I've built for this weird kind of energy defense team, or maybe I see the energy defense as a weakness. So I prefer that aspect of Meteors, where Swords is kind of, in my opinion, generically good. I can't really think of a team that's going to excel at this more than another team, outside of I have more activations than you, I have more pushes, throws, and things of that nature. I like the Meteors brought something that is not commonly associated with power level, which is energy defense, kind of into how well it uses the crisis.
Yeah, so definitely I agree with you. All of the things that make you good at Swords are the same things that make you good at every other secure, right? If you can stay on points and if you can push other people off points. And I think you could take either side of the argument that Deadly Meteors caring about energy defense is a cool twist versus a unnecessary gimmick, right? Is it cool that if I build my team with energy defense, I get an advantage? Or does it suck that I can't play the characters I want because they've got 2 energy defense on this crisis, right? I think both points of view there are valid, but also I don't think this is a topic that many people feel strongly about.
Yeah, I don't think this is a make or break topic for many people playing Marvel Crisis Protocol. Just prefer I don't know if we've talked about this on pod. I know we've talked about this off of pod, Pat. I like it when a crisis really fits with a roster, where you can see clear synergies between the characters to their tactics to how they interact with some of the crises you selected. I think Deadly Meteor gives you that opportunity. I don't think Sword does. Because to me, Sword is just, you're playing Marvel. You're going to be okay at this. And that to me is the difference.
So I would counter that. I think there's 2 things about Sword that would make it appealing for specific rosters. The first is the C-map. We actually don't have very many secures on C-map, right? We've got Terrigen, Mr. Mare, Fist, but they're not true C-maps because they don't have a central point. And then the only other is Deadly Meteors, which, as we've talked about, has this weird bias towards energy defense. So this is the first C-map secure where any character is good. And I think for that reason, it could be popular for teams who want an alternative to the speed of Gamma, but want to bring characters in the middle to fight. I think this could be appealing for those brawling teams. And you might see some people experiment with Sword Base plus Demons Downtown, with Sword Base replacing Gamma, if they're trying to force a fight and they don't particularly want to score quickly. So, first off, what do you think about that?
So you're saying that a brawly team could take this in lieu of
Gamma Wave.
So you're thinking this would be closer to Demons then, right?
Yeah. So if I just want to fight you, I want a central secure to force you to come in, but I don't particularly want you to be able to score lots of points quickly. And Gamma Wave is this kind of double-edged sword where I take it to force you in, but I don't love the fact that if things go badly for me, you could score 6 points. Mm-hmm. And this, the most you can get is 3, but you're still forced into the middle of the table.
Sure, I guess I could see that argument. I mean, I guess my argument is that you could score it without being in the middle of the table, which is the negative, right, where it kind of differs from Demons. But I do like it as a pair with Demons, right? And the other crisis where, like, well, there's really nothing I would pair this with. I get if you say, you know what, I'm going to drop Gamma, I'm going to take Sword and Demons. Those are going to be my two brawling secures. Because they're both slow. We're talking 3 a round as opposed to Gamma being 6, which is just obscene, right? Yeah. And then in one way or another, I'm going to utilize these kind of pockets. Now, I do think it's interesting, right? The heroes that I normally associate being good with Demons aren't the best at Sword. But I guess to your point, that is where you could gain an advantage, right? If you're able to pivot into these things that can get wide, support wide, move back and forth, maybe using Mothership or Asteroid, or, you know, maybe even a left to right portals could be interesting. I think that could be interesting. So sure, I could follow you along there. So while it doesn't have the interact thing, you're thinking mainly just the deployment and the scoring mechanic on it are enough to drive some interesting conversations around it.
Yeah, I think so. And then I think the other thing that helps give it a niche is the threat value, right? It's only 14 threat.
That I do think is important, for sure.
Right? It's a big deal. It's the lowest threat value in the game. We've only got one other crisis of 14 threat, and that is an extract. So this is the first secure. And it's hard to make good teams at 14 threat for a lot of squads.
Yeah, and I think it is... I think that is probably the most relevant thing about it is can you do you have a good 14 in your pocket where your opponent might not have a great answer for it?
Yeah. 14 threat puts quite a lot of pressure on your team of what it can do, right? And there might be situations where your opponent has to have quite a low model count to make 14 threat, and at which point it's only 3 points you have to get on the table, but that might be too much for some teams at 14.
And I do think it's worth also noting that the 14 threat, because previously you probably needed a plan for 14 anyway, right, to deal with mutant extremists or U.S. senators. And while that is also a C-map, these play very differently, right? And I do think it's worth noting that your 14 for senators is probably not going to be the same 14 you run out there for sword base.
Yeah, probably not. So I do think that's interesting. And who knows, you might get some squads that becomes specialists at 14, where maybe people will identify some really powerful combinations that are very difficult for some lists to beat at 14 threat. And indeed, I mean, some of the most popular affiliations right now are Brotherhood and A-Force with 6 threat cost leaders a lot of the time, right? And it can be really tough to make the perfect 14 threat team when you have this big 6-point chunk that you're trying to fit in.
Yeah, I mean, Brotherhood does a pretty nice 14, right? But that's a whole other conversation, right? I mean, you can do the cheap core of 11 plus Valkyrie to 14. I think that would be something I would be willing to play in Sword Base just fine.
Yeah, you could also do the family, right? Magneto, Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch. Difficult to please is 14.
Yeah, you certainly could. You could also just do the 2 of them plus Lockjaw, which I wouldn't like on the C. Yeah, I wouldn't like that. I take that back. Don't do that.
You could also forsake Magneto and have Mystique leadership. You've definitely got options.
Nah, you've gone off the rails now, Pat.
Fair enough.
So I think that's interesting. I hadn't considered that before. Maybe I need to try it more with the brawly teams of this wide brawly teams. as opposed to the horizontal, so to speak. So I like half a sword base. I really like the first half of the interact. I wish the second half of the interact had some more keywords, but you've made me at least consider some different ways to approach the crisis.
So there's good. I'm glad. There's one more thing I wanted to talk about with sword base, which is something I've seen a lot of people criticize. And I'm wondering if they're right. I think they might be, but I'd love to get your take. And that is that in most crises in MCP, there's usually some sort of comeback mechanic where having the crisis gives you a disadvantage. Now, in some, there's a small advantage to be had. But in this crisis, it has perhaps the biggest and most one-sided advantage, where only one player can get the benefit of the push. But getting a free push is very powerful, especially because it actively makes it harder for your opponent to get back into this crisis game, right? It pushes them off the secure points, makes it easier for you to keep your lead. What do you think about that?
I like it personally. And the main reason I like it is because we've talked about it before. It's a relatively speaking small amount of VPs. And this is another reason to incentivize people to play the crisis. I like people playing the crisis in Marvel Crisis Protocol. And I like that this incentivizes people to do so without it being victory point focused.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. And maybe actually, maybe that's a reason why Brody teams don't want it. If your plan is not to score this, but just to force conflict, maybe you will be regretting your decision when your primary damage dealing character gets pushed every round.
Yeah, that's an interesting. If you're playing the traditional Black Order, which is I'm just going to punch you a lot, you know, that free short push on Corvus every round is just going to be obnoxious, right? Like, that's you're literally losing one plus attacks on Corvus every round, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then other murder characters traditionally are really vulnerable to pushes, right? MODOK being a fantastic example, where a push is the equivalent to a stagger on him most of the time.
Yeah, and She-Hulk as well, right? She has ways to combat some pushes, but not this one.
Yeah, exactly. So
what do you think of the mechanic, though, Pat?
I want to play it a bit more before I pass judgment. It's definitely very powerful. It makes me wonder if it is enough for this to become a premier choice for secure focused teams. Because even if you're only scoring 3 points, the fact your opponent is scoring none makes the differential a lot higher than most secures. Maybe it's just too slow. But I think it's interesting, and I don't know where I stand right now, but it's definitely caught my eye. And I tell you what, if it were legal for the start of Season 5, I would probably be playing it in my current roster.
Just for the repetitions?
Yeah, and because I think it complements my strategy more than Deadly Meteors, which I've currently got.
That's fair. Okay, I can get behind that. And this is one of those crises where I think you would not surprise me either way. If this crisis ended up being the bottom of the barrel for popularity, wouldn't shock me. If this crisis ended up being, I wouldn't expect it like gamma wave level of popularity. But if this ended up with being right in the middle of the bell curve, or even on the high end of the bell curve, that wouldn't shock me either. I could really see it going either way. And a lot is just going to be how the community chooses to adopt this and its reception, right? Which is not a hot take and is me just blibbering for 30 seconds. But I think really, generally, we have to see what the masses think about it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how this one shakes out. But I do think it's pretty cool.
All right, so I think that wraps up this episode. I want to thank each and every one of you so much for listening. Patreons, you can stay tuned for the after the credit scene. We're going to be wrapping up for real the last episode, the last miniseries episode we have on Season 5 of the TTS. We're going to be diving into why Pat is playing a list we did not cover and so much more. But till next time, everyone, cheers and happy gaming.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high, there's a pod that I've heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere across the Bifrost skies are. And the dreams dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.